Hey there, it's Kimberly Adams from Marketplace, in for Joshua Johnson. Just a quick note before we start the show. A lot of news has broken today and is still breaking. This podcast was recorded earlier, so we discuss a lot of what's been happening, but not everything. So to stay up to date on the very latest, you should keep an ear out on your NPR member station or go online to npr.org. Thanks. This is 1A. I'm Kimberly Adams from Marketplace, in for Joshua Johnson. Happy Friday. We are thrilled to have you along for this week's Friday News Roundup. Lots of news to dive into this week. The battles over abortion continue with Nevada lifting restrictions on the procedure. McDonald's workers go on strike. And inside the Beltway, President Trump gave the Attorney General new powers to review the 2016 inquiry into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. Meanwhile, former White House counsel Don McGahn defied a subpoena to appear before the House Judiciary Committee. House Democrats aren't happy, and now one House Republican says the president has engaged in actions that meet the threshold for impeachment. Could this be the turning point? That's where we'll start this week on the Friday News Roundup. Joining me is Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, great to see you.
Good to be here.
Edward Luce, he's chief U.S. columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. His latest book is The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And also in studio with us is Anita Kumar, a White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Anita, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me back.
Now, Lisa, let's start with you. Yesterday, President Trump gave Attorney General William Barr new authorities to conduct a review into how that 2016 Trump campaign's ties to Russia were investigated. Tell us more about this directive and what authorities it gives Barr.
This was a really remarkable move at the end of a dizzying news week of presidential versus congressional powers. And what the president did here, we learned from a statement from the press secretary at the White House, Sarah Sanders, was that he directed all 16 intelligence agencies to give the attorney general any information he wants about the investigation into Russia and whether Russia was working with Trump officials themselves. The idea from President Trump and from conservatives is that this was a political investigation, that Trump himself was the target. Of course, Democrats push back. Now, in addition to directing these agencies to cooperate, the president gave the attorney general some notable and very important powers. He can declassify information on his own when he thinks it's important to this investigation. Democrats have swiftly reacted to that and said that is weaponizing our intelligence. And it is something that intelligence officials generally would be very nervous about because they could declassify who, what, when, sources and methods that involve people's lives and involve years and years of work because of an investigation that involves the president and political concerns on all sides.
So let's be clear, Lisa, we're not just talking about declassifying information to Congress, but declassifying information to the public. And what's the significance of that?
It's highly significant. Now, it is up to Barr how he declassifies, for what purpose, and to whom. But again, this is something that I think the intelligence communities are going to have to look at very carefully. And I've only spoken to one person that I know that's involved in this, and they're nervous. They're not sure how this is going to work.
Ed, this appears to significantly escalate the administration's efforts to place those who investigated the campaign under scrutiny. What's your take on all this?
That Trump is not going to back off from the threat to investigate the investigators. That the divorce between the Trump administration and the federal agencies, not just the intelligence agencies, but at the FBI, elements of the Department of Justice, between how they see their role, which is a public service role, and what Trump accuses them of, is just going to become more and more bitter over the coming months, because it serves President Trump's political purposes to turn back the investigations on the Democrats.
Aaron tweets, I'm concerned that Barr will use these new authorities like he did the Mueller report to tell us selective facts that favor Trump's side. Anita, is that a risk?
Well, I think Democrats think it is. I mean, this is sort of solidifies this investigation, and now these powers that he has sort of solidifies that you know, what the Democrats are talking about. They're saying he's the attorney for the president and not for the country. So they are worried that he will selectively do this, that he'll look into things that the president wants him to, that he'll just do what the president wants. So I think that you're going to see a lot of pushback on it. But again, he does have this authority now. He does have the intelligence community that should be cooperating. So I think we're going to see this for, you know, the next, you know, several months or so. Also, good to note that the Inspector General at the Department of Justice is also investigating, and that investigation should end in May or June. So we're going to be hearing about this pretty soon.
Let's move now to Don McGahn. He served as White House counsel, and his name frequently appears in the Mueller report. He was subpoenaed to appear before the House Judiciary Committee on Tuesday at the direction of President Trump. McGahn decided not to appear, even though he no longer works for the White House. Anita, staying with you, what's the Trump administration's angle here?
The angle pretty much has been with everyone, and not just him, although he is a very key player here, is that they don't feel that these aides, even former aides, should be testifying. And so you've seen a couple times now where the administration, the White House, is saying, we don't think you should testify, and the aides are going along with that. Now, clearly some of these things are going to end up in court because the House Democrats are going to push back on this. But they have almost completely said, we don't think that certain documents should go over. We don't think aides should testify. And they've kind of stuck to that. I mean, they're not even, in many cases, they're not even sort of sending back the customary letters that just say, hey, you know, the polite response that says, hey, we don't think we need to give you this, and here's why. We're just seeing these letters that are very strongly worded that says you don't have any legitimate reason to ask for this.
And Ed, what can the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Nadler, even do about this?
Well, I don't think, as far as I understand, he has the power to disbar Don McGahn. I mean, Don McGahn is on his own bat able to testify. He's not bound to the White House directive on this.
Because he no longer works for the
White House. But he does work for Jones Day, which is a law firm that, you know, does a lot of business with people around the White House. And so there could be a chilling effect there if he agreed to testify. There could be, a contempt ruling against him, a motion passed against him. Again, though, that's, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder. If he doesn't think it's worth anything that and isn't shamed by it, that's not going to incentivize him to testify. So the subpoena will go through. There will be a subpoena that will go through the courts to compel him to testify. And so ultimately, I presume it will be up to the courts.
Right. There is discussion now of something highly unusual among Democrats, because I think they are, in a way, eager and in another way desperate to get more information, which is the idea of inherent contempt, that Congress, since the founding of the country, has had its own power to enforce its own investigations. And in 1935 was the last time that Congress actually did this. Congress can issue fines. Congress in the past jailed people for not cooperating. It doesn't sound, and I don't know any Democrats who are going to send the sergeant of arms of the House to the Department of Justice to arrest the attorney general, as much as Aaron Sorkin might be wondering what would happen there. But I do think it would be notable if Congress tried, in a time when, this is what I hear from Democrats, in a time when the president is seeming to flex or push his powers as far as he can, some Democrats want to push their congressional powers as far as they can.
So speaking of the presidential and congressional powers, what does all of this mean for the separation of powers among the branches of government? Anita.
Well, I mean, you're hearing from House Democrats saying that the president doesn't believe that Congress is an equal branch of government. I think that pretty much all of these big issues are going to go to the third branch of government, and we're going to see fights in the courts. And, you know, it takes a little while to get there, and so I think we're going to slowly see some of them get there. But we've already started to see that President Trump has lost, you know, his first few battles in the courts. Now, it hasn't gone all the way to the Supreme Court. We're just at lower levels here, but he's lost a few battles. They have said that he has said he's going to appeal. I think it's eventually here going to get to the Supreme Court.
As a coda, it's just worth mentioning that Don McGahn worked very closely with Mitch McConnell to get Federalist Society kind of judges onto the appeals court. Something like 40 out of 179 judges now serving there were pushed through since Trump was inaugurated.
And you point out the Federalist Society, because these are conservative-leaning judges.
Very conservative, and not just conservative. They take an expansive, generally, these 40 judges take a very expansive view of executive power.
And it's interesting, one of those judges that President Trump appointed and went through the McConnell Senate is on the three-person panel that will be deciding the latest appeals case in regards to the financial records going through President Trump's accounting firm. You know, I think I was thinking about this last night. There's just too much happening. And in a way, that advantages the president, right? Because it's hard to focus on any one thing. So I think it's important to lay out, essentially, there are five sort of realms of investigations going on. One on the Mueller report, but another on the president's finances. Those are the two main things we're talking about right now, and that's where Democrats think the biggest questions are. However, there are other questions about how White House officials have handled security reviews, also the campaign finance hush money with the president, and then, of course, there are many questions about immigration policy. So there are a lot of investigations going on right now. As Anita points out, Democrats are taking some hope from court rulings this week that seem to be moving quickly and so far in their favor.
Ed, very quickly, Lisa mentioned the accounting troubles. Can you give a quick summary of what's happening there with the president?
Well, the Democratic, the House has subpoenaed Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, and the Trump administration is saying this is an intrusion into his privacy and those of his family and descendants, etc. As Lisa mentioned, the courts, an appeal court this week, upheld the congressional right to issue a subpoena. It's going to take months and months for this to reach a resolution. And although this has been a victory on two or three fronts legally this week for the Democrats, furthering their investigative inquiries, we're probably not going to get anywhere before 2020.
Still to come, we'll talk about the top business news this week. Ford cut 7,000 jobs, and McDonald's workers went on strike. I'm Kimberly Adams, happy to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for 1A and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. Conversations and civil debate in our society push us forward and connect us with the rest of the world. With the Platinum Card, earn 5x membership rewards points on flights booked directly with airlines or with American Express Travel. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Don't live life without it. Visit americanexpress.com/exploreplatinum. Terms apply.
It's 1965. A white minister is murdered in Selma, Alabama, but no one is held to account.
More than 50 years later, we return to the place where it happened, to call a lie, and finally solve this murder.
White Lies, from NPR. New episodes drop Tuesdays.
I'm Kimberly Adams, and this is the Friday News Roundup on 1A. We have an email from Pat in Kansas. She says, I find it ludicrous that the president claims to be the most transparent president in the history of the country as he continues to withhold his tax records and other business documents requested by congressional committees. How is this being transparent? Coming back, Anita, the president's financial secrecy woes took another hit this week when the New York Times dropped a detailed report based in part on interviews with the anti-money laundering specialist at Deutsche Bank. Can you tell us about the details of that report?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think the way I sort of look at this to the point of the person who wrote in was just that the president has been very clear that he feels that his finances are just off limits, right? He does not want to reveal information. Not only does it deal with his businesses, but also deals with his children who are involved in his business. To him, that's very personal. But yes, there are very big questions, as there's been news reports about sort of money laundering allegations and also allegations of where did the president get the funding for some of his, his businesses around the world, which foreign governments were involved or foreign entities were involved. And I think there's just a lot of questions like that, that we've heard, seen little bits and pieces here, but we just don't have the full picture of that.
Ed, what were the red flags that these anti-money laundering specialists saw?
dozens of them, but both from the Trump Organization and various entities and the Kushner Company when
Jared was
chief executive in 2016 and then in 2017 again. There were dozens and dozens of reports, suspicious activity reports recommended by employees at Deutsche Bank over the movement of large amounts of money across borders, particularly to Russia. And the Deutsche Bank senior management chose not to pass it on to the Treasury. Very, very unusual to get that many suspicious activity report recommendations and for none to be passed on. And of course, the answer as to why is that, you know, Deutsche Bank is a big lender to the Trump Organization and the Kushner Companies. And now that he's president, and in 2016 looked likely maybe to become president, they didn't want to chill their future. It's a very troubled bank.
But I can't imagine that was the bank's official reasoning for why they didn't pass this on to regulators. What did they say?
They did fire the woman, Tammy McFadden, who, you know, originated most of these SAR recommendations. They said that they didn't feel there was enough grounds or evidence to pass it on. They had various reasons. One other channel, which was improper according to her, was that her recommendations were passed to the private arm of Deutsche Bank, which is the main one that did business with Donald Trump, and which therefore had a conflict of interest in adjudicating whether these suspicious activity reports were valid or not.
Moving on, New York State lawmakers opened up another line of inquiry into President Trump's finances. On Wednesday, they signed and sent a bill to Governor Cuomo that would allow Congress to access the president's state tax return. Lisa, how would this legislation work?
So there are three committees in Congress that New York State would allow to request the state tax returns. Before those committees could get those returns, they would have to also request the federal tax returns from the IRS, which, of course, we know Democrats through the House Ways and Means Committee have already done. What we see here is Democrats essentially trying to operate on as many fronts as they can to get information on the president, federal and state. The Democrats in Congress right now are not motivated to get these New York State tax returns. They are focused on the federal tax returns. And I don't think they want to spend a lot of time on the battle to get the state returns in the court. They're going to let state officials work that out, but they're not yet planning to request these returns. That's significant. However, this is sort of a card they can hold in their back pocket, and that's what it's intended to be.
The relationship between President Trump and congressional Democrats sunk even lower this week. It kicked off on Wednesday morning when House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told reporters why some Democrats are continuing to pursue impeachment.
We do believe that it's important for to follow the facts. We believe that no one is above the law, including the President of the United States, and we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up.
Speaker Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer then went to the White House to negotiate a $2 trillion infrastructure plan. The president reportedly left the meeting without sitting down or shaking anybody's hands, and he then held his own press conference in the White House Rose Garden immediately after and explained why he left the meeting.
And instead of walking in happily into a meeting, I walk in to look at people that had just said that I was doing a cover-up. I don't do cover-ups. You people know that probably better than anybody.
Trump says he won't work with Democrats while they pursue investigations against him. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said it was all a pre-planned stunt. Anita, what does this mean for the investigations and for bipartisan relations moving forward?
I don't think there's too many bipartisan relationships going on right now. Look, President Trump said the day after the November election, after Democrats won the House, that he was going to have trouble working with them if they went ahead with the investigations. We did see some signs a few weeks ago that they were working together on infrastructure and more recently on the budget, but they haven't really done that much together. And he's been very clear that he thinks that one is related to the other. He can't seem to sort of compartmentalize them. So he's connected them and he says he's just not going to work with them. Now, I do think that probably he and the House Democrats will realize over time here that they, in order to get anything done before the 2020 elections, they have to work together. It's divided government. So I think you're going to see them try again. Now, if anything comes of it, who knows? But I think we'll see them sit down again.
A couple of comments from you. Martin tweets, the American people find the Democrats' activities, RE Trump, a total waste of time. Pelosi, Nadler, and co. are in their own vindictive world, still refusing to face the fact that the president won in 2016. Get to the business of the people. Chase emails, when will Robert Mueller testify before Congress? Lisa?
Those negotiations are ongoing. It's not clear. It was supposed to be last week, but now it is a date uncertain. There are many complicated aspects to that negotiation. It is tied up in a lot of dynamics, including the fact that Robert Mueller is set to leave the Justice Department and become a private citizen soon. But I think speaking back to this idea of bipartisanship and the really wild last 2 days we've had, I was at several of the news conferences with Speaker Pelosi when she was speaking at the Capitol, and we saw her ramp up the rhetoric against the president yesterday in a very unusual news conference for her, really going on the attack. I think the big point to me is that there actually is bipartisan agreement at the Capitol. Republicans and Democrats have been working together. We saw that on the disaster funding bill that went through the Senate last night and may go through the House today, despite containing things that the president objects to. It's because Republicans want that bill. Same thing on budget funding. So it's really not the parties. It's really the president versus Nancy Pelosi where the divide is, or the president versus Democrats. So he's gotten in the way of some potential bipartisan agreement, and we saw that again this week.
And speaking of a rare moment of crossing the aisle, we now have one lone House Republican who says the president has engaged in actions that meet the threshold for impeachment. Michigan Republican Representative Justin Amash laid out his case for impeaching President Trump in a series of tweets. Ed, who is Representative Amash, and what does this mean?
He's a young-ish congressman, fifth term from Michigan. He's actually originally one of the Tea Party wave. And he's taken a lonely, principled stand within the GOP that what the Mueller report laid out, is corruption and it's Congress's constitutional duty to act on it. Now, both the president and Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, have said, oh, he's just trying to get attention and, you know, he votes with Pelosi anyway. But actually, if you look at his ratings from conservative groups, he's got a pretty consistently fiscally conservative record and anti-abortion record. He's got a good rating from most of those groups. He'll probably be primaried now. One or two names have already suggested that. And Trump, you know, has a pretty devastating record of succeeding when he supports candidates who primary what he sees as renegade Republicans. Mark Sanford, the former governor of South Carolina, being one example. He'd spoken out against Trump. So Amash is probably going to be primary. But I guess he's going to get some applause from some people as being consistent in his principles. He voted against Obama consistently, and he's standing up against Trump when he believes that's his duty to do so.
This week, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson appeared before the House Financial Services Committee, and throughout the hearing, the secretary and the lawmakers were on different pages on a number of issues.
I'd also like you to get back to me, if you don't mind, to explain the disparity in REO rates. Do you know what an REO is?
An OREO?
An REO. REO.
Real estate?
What's the O stand for?
E-organization.
Owned. Real estate owned. That's what happens when a property goes to foreclosure. We call it an REO.
That was an exchange between California Representative Katie Porter and Secretary Carson during the hearing. Representative Porter later told CNN that Secretary Carson sent a family-sized box of double-stuffed Oreos to her office. She said, quote, while I was pleased to receive correspondence from him, what I'm really looking for is answers, end quote. We have an email from Michael who says, Ben Carson is unfit for his job. REO is not a joke. It's a demonstration of his complete unfitness for his job. Don't make it a joke. Not knowing the basic details of the housing industry hurts Americans. Anita, very quickly, what does this exchange tell us about the relationship between Congress and Secretary Carson?
Well, it's just a bigger problem that House Democrats see, which is, and actually some Republicans, that the president appointed, nominated people that were not well-versed in their jobs. And Ben Carson is one of those people that didn't have housing experience, and people thought he shouldn't have that job. This interaction just shows that he doesn't know some of those things, or he was joking, I don't know. But you saw what his response was. His response was, this is partisan. They're trying to get me to say the wrong thing. They're trying to just show that prove that I don't know something, but I do know what this is.
What indication does that exchange give us about the way the rest of the hearing went?
You know, I think notable in this, that was sort of the attention-getting moment. But we've seen in the last day another important moment emerge from that hearing, which is when another freshman congresswoman, Jennifer Wexton of Virginia, asked about the Housing and Urban Development the HUD's policy about equal access, which right now says it does not discriminate based on gender identity. And she asked the Secretary Carson, she asked him, is there a chance you could revoke that rule? He said, I'm not going to say exactly our plans, but I do not believe currently we have plans to change that. The next day, his department announced they are changing it. And in fact, that they would allow some of their contractors to discriminate and to no longer provide housing for transgender Americans or also on the base of religion. Now, so the housing secretary did not seem to be familiar with a very significant policy that was about to change, or he withheld that fact from a member of Congress. That's really significant because that's affecting many lives, and that's affecting a very controversial policy that the public should be allowed to debate and did not get the opportunity. So Jennifer Wexton is, among others, asking for him to resign based on that. So it was a significant hearing, not just in terms of what he knows and how he's operating, but in terms of what the Trump administration and Secretary Carson is disclosing about thousands of lives, people who live in his housing.
In other cabinet news, on Wednesday, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin announced plans to unveil the Harriet Tubman $20 bill would be postponed until at least 2026. According to some senior Treasury officials, Secretary Mnuchin was eager to delay the Obama-era initiative until after President Trump was out of office. On the campaign trail in 2016, then-candidate Trump praised President Andrew Jackson, who is currently on the 20, and called the change, quote, pure political correctness, end quote. Let's move on to another topic, abortion, which was in the news so much this week. The wave of new anti-abortion laws passed this year has sparked nationwide protests. Some 400 demonstrations were planned for Tuesday, including a rally outside the U.S. Supreme Court. Alabama passed what is considered the most restrictive anti-abortion law in the country. The ban makes no exceptions for cases of rape or incest. Other states, including Georgia, Mississippi, Missouri, and Ohio, passed laws prohibiting abortions after a heartbeat is detected. Anita, what can we expect to come from these protests?
I think we're going to hear a lot about this from Democrats. We're already hearing about it from the Democrats on the presidential campaign trail. They're using this as, you know, this is the country's going in the wrong direction. Of course, they're not in charge of the states, and they wouldn't be if they were president, but they would have, you know, the bully pulpit to talk about these issues across the state. So interesting, because if you'll remember from last year, President Trump and the Republicans really used bills that some of them didn't really go anywhere in Virginia and New York that would have done the opposite, right? They say they were too liberal on abortion and would have allowed abortion at a very late stage. And they were using this against Democrats last year. So now the tables have sort of turned, I feel like. And this year we're going to hear a lot of a lot of Democrats talking about these bills.
But what's the likelihood of any of these new laws actually being overturned?
Well, I think we're going to see, if we haven't already, we're going to see them end up in the courts. That's the answer to everything, isn't it? We're going to see a lot of challenges to these bills that have been passed. Many of them have been passed, and governors who have put them into law, but I think they're going to end up in the courts.
Nevada made a move in the opposite direction when the state assembly lifted restrictions on abortions Tuesday, some of which have been in place for decades. Lisa, can you tell us more about what this would do?
This will affect women in that state, but it's mainly symbolic because Nevada did not have very strict abortion laws. It didn't have a conservative approach to abortion to begin with. But among the things that Nevada has done here, it has removed requirements such as the requirement to tell women about the emotional effects of an abortion before they go through that procedure. They're basically trying to ease the situation for women there. That is something, of course, that abortion opponents say is not helpful, and that you're kind of keeping information from women that they need and making a choice. But it really is a political statement here, and what we're seeing overall is just yet another step toward dividing America along extreme political lines, when the truth is most of America is in the middle on a topic like abortion. They want it legal, but with some restrictions.
More of the Friday News Roundup is just ahead. We'll talk about how billionaire Robert Smith made a surprise announcement that would pay off the student loans of roughly 400 graduates of Morehouse College. With that in mind, here's the Morehouse College Glee Club singing "I'm Building Me a Home." We're back in a minute. Stay close.
When you hear me shouting, I'm building me a home.
Lord.
When you hear me
shouting,
I'm building me a home.
Support also comes from Google. Veteran Mitch Hoyt founded Skinny Sticks Maple Syrup, and he's showing that small businesses can do big things. Mitch started making syrup from a few trees in his Wisconsin backyard and now is connecting with customers worldwide with help from Google Tools. Skinny Sticks is one of millions of small businesses using Google to grow. Learn how Google is helping businesses in your state at google.com/economic impact.
So, how many candidates are running for president?
22. Maybe more to come. It is a lot to keep track of, which is why the NPR Politics Podcast is hitting the road to introduce you to all the people running for president.
Join us on the campaign trail as we interview the candidates to ask why they are the best pick for president. Follow along this spring and summer by subscribing to the NPR Politics Podcast.
Let's get to a few more stories from the news of the week with Lisa Desjardins with the PBS NewsHour, Edward Luce with the Financial Times, and Anita Kumar with Politico. Lisa, let's start back with you. We just found out this week that another 10-year-old girl died in immigration custody in September. Five children have reportedly died in border custody since December. Three of those deaths were in the past couple of weeks, a 16-year-old boy, a 10-year-old girl, and a 2-year-old boy. The two boys died in the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The girl died in Mexico's custody. Has any of this triggered a change in the protocol for how we deal with minors at the border?
No, and I think even more disturbing, it hasn't changed anything about the transparency of these deaths. We learned of that sixth death this week, but that was after, first of all, the acting Homeland Security Secretary testified about children's death. He did not reveal that to Congress. We learned about it afterward, and that death happened last year. So the issue is we do not have information about many of these deaths. We have a severe lack of information about treatment of the tens of thousands of people that are in custody, and there is a complete communication breakdown between Congress and the president over how to deal with that situation.
And not much indication that that's going to change anytime soon.
Not now.
We're going to switch gears to business news now. Graduates of Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, received much more than a hard-earned degree and a pat on the back on Sunday. They got what many college graduates of their generation can only dream of, a life free of student debt.
On behalf of the 8 generations of my family who have been in this country, we're going to put a little fuel in your bus. This is my class, 2019, and my family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
That was Robert F. Smith, the richest African-American in the country and the college's 2019 commencement speaker. He pledged to pay off the student loan debt for the nearly 400 graduates. Smith is the founder of the private equity firm Vista Equity Partners and is worth about $5 billion. Morehouse is the only all-male, historically black college in the country. Its notable graduates include Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Spike Lee, and Samuel L. Jackson. Ed, what is the significance of this happening at a historically black college, especially an all-male one?
Well, first of all, it must have been probably the best commencement ceremony in history. They weren't expecting this. Look, I think it's very significant for many reasons, but there are two that leap out. One is we are in the midst of, you know, a slow motion student debt crisis. You know, there's no one moment where it spills over into a dramatic crisis, but there's a whole generation that are being, you know, really stifled in their career choices and weighed down by debt because of student loans. And so this was an immensely dramatic gesture. The second thing, though, as the richest, you know, as a very, very big private equity guy and the richest black person in America, you know, this was a voice of the plutocracy saying, I feel your pain. I understand what you're going through. Tiny bit of controversy over, you know, what his private philanthropy, the gap between his private philanthropy and what he supports politically. So, for example, you know, when there were proposals under the Obama administration to end the carried interest loophole, which basically allows hedge funds and private equity firms to pay much lower taxes, normal income taxes, he opposed closing that loophole. And, you know, perhaps a lot more money could be given to students if that loophole were closed than what he's going to give by taking on their debt. But overall, you know, an extraordinary gesture which, you know, focuses the debate. And I suspect, you know, he'll come out on top as having done a very, very good gesture.
And it's estimated to cost, what, somewhere between $10 and $40 million. Dollars?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
He's getting a lot of requests for commencement.
Yeah. I can only imagine. Okay. And staying on business news, the Ford Motor Company announced this week that it plans to eliminate 7,000 salaried jobs. That's about 10% of its global white-collar workforce. CEO Jim Hackett wrote in a memo to employees that eliminating these positions will save the company around $600 million a year. Is Ford in financial trouble, Anita?
Well, it's the same thing that we're seeing from other automobile companies. So, in fact, Ford, for those significant numbers you just said, is actually doing better than some of the other ones. I think we've seen greater losses at other companies. You know, I think that there's a lot of talk about, oh, the economy is doing so well. You know, the president likes to say that, Republicans like to say that, but there are a lot of people that are still out of work or they're going to be out of work, and it's going to be a major debate going forward. Not everybody is doing well, and there's some issues still happening, and so I think we're going to hear a lot about that.
Ed, what do we know about global car demand these days? I mean, has it peaked?
No, it hasn't peaked. But the American, the big three of Detroit, Ford, GM, Chrysler, you know, are feeling the squeeze. And the crossfire of the tariff wars that the president is pursuing has complicated life for all global car companies in terms of where they, how they adjust their supply chains. The uncertainty about what he'll do next. There is a sort of Damoclean sword hanging over auto tariffs. He's put off for 6 months the decision whether to impose 25% tariffs on auto imports. That makes it really difficult, not just for foreign car companies, but for American ones, because all of them are global. You know, wherever they're technically headquartered, all of them have global supply chains. And so this uncertainty makes it really hard to make long-term investment decisions.
Especially in the midst of the trade war.
Indeed.
All right. And let's turn now to the food industry, where two stories made headlines this week.
We're here. We're allowed. Sexual harassment is not allowed. We're here. We're allowed. Sexual harassment is not allowed.
Me too, McDonald's. Me too, McDonald's. Me too, McDonald's.
That's the sound of McDonald's employees striking around the country yesterday. Many say they have faced sexual harassment in the workplace and are calling on the company to do more to prevent it. Lisa, what else do we know about these strikes?
It's fascinating. We're seeing kind of our political divide really now come into headlines in real people's lives. And that's what you were seeing here. Some 13 cities, I believe, saw these workers striking. They're demanding better wages. They want $15 an hour or more, a working wage. It's not the first time we've heard that phrase, but that push is growing from those people who are earning less than the people in power. And we also saw notably three Democratic presidential candidates marching with these workers. So they're trying to make a statement that they hope will help further their career and say, this is what I'm about. I'm about working Americans, which Democrats fear they lost to some extent in the 2016 election, or lost more than they wanted.
The strikes did coincide with the launch of the 2020 program Fight for 15, which is a fair wage campaign that aims to make workers' rights a centerpiece of the presidential election. As you mentioned, Lisa, White House hopefuls, including Julian Ben Castro, Bill de Blasio, and Senator Bernie Sanders have said they will join the workers' efforts. Anita, what do you make of this as a campaign strategy?
I think it, I mean, we have been seeing, and we saw in 2016, that the minimum wage was a significant political issue. And I think it's going to be even more significant this time around. You know, the people that are fighting for $15 an hour have had some successes across the states in some companies, and they feel like there's sort of some momentum. So, I mean, I think it's exactly what Lisa said. They feel like presidential candidates and others, you know, not just the candidates for president, but for, you know, Congress, are going to be using this to say, we hear you. We understand that when the Republicans say the economy is great, it's not great for everyone. And so I think you're going to hear that. It's really sort of the economy is going to be the significant thing, I think, coming up in this election, because there is that divide.
Ed, how has McDonald's responded to these strikes and lawsuits so far?
Well, it says it pays the federal minimum wage, which is $10.10, but considerably lower than the $15 the organizers of these protests are asking for. I mean, it's very, just to pick up on something Lisa and Anita said, you know, there is a really interesting sort of cognitive dissonance, if you like, between Trump saying best economy ever, the unemployment numbers being 50-year highs, or I'm sorry, lows, and the fact that we've now got more strikes in America in the last year than we've seen for a generation. There is more worker unrest. And I think, so the economy in aggregate is doing well, but people aren't feeling it at the personal level. And McDonald's employees are a really classic example, because McDonald's is not taking fiduciary responsibility for a whole host of things that happen to employees at its 14,000 franchises across America, including sexual harassment suits, that it says, well, we're not responsible for this. The franchisees are. And of course, minimum wage and the right to organize, to join a union. So McDonald's is saying, you know, don't ask me, I don't work there. It's just our brand. And they're holding their annual AGM down in Dallas, which is the focal point of these protests. But I think it's a really good microcosmic example of how the conventional numbers say America's doing really well, but people aren't feeling it.
Even though some of the strongest wage growth we've seen is at the bottom. And I think you wanted to follow up on something?
A correction, very kindly scribbled on a note by Lisa for me. $10.10 was what Obama proposed for the federal minimum wage. It's $7.25 in reality, my apologies.
Which is not really a living wage in most of the United States. But back to that lower end wage growth, why aren't people feeling the quote-unquote good economy?
You know, I think it depends on where you look. We're seeing kind of a regionalized economy here in the United States, and that can even happen within cities. I think that we also see increasing disparity. So that's a problem. That's kind of overriding over all of this is the issue, is that the gains in the economy are not being spread out. And we still see people who cannot afford childcare, people who cannot afford to even think about tuition payments for growing children. All that healthcare, still a very real problem for many, many Americans.
And we're also following the latest on another fast food chain, Chick-fil-A. On Tuesday, the Texas House advanced legislation that is called Save Chick-fil-A. It's a bill that supporters say will defend Chick-fil-A and religious freedom. Opponents say the legislation could open the door for discrimination of the state's LGBTQ community. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott has signaled he will sign the bill, which has already moved through the state House and Senate. What will this mean in practice if it's implemented? Have you heard anything about this bill,
Anita? Yeah, it's interesting that you're saying that people are saying it would allow discrimination, because actually I saw some reporting that said it actually wouldn't change that much, that there already some of those protections are there and it wouldn't. I mean, I guess we'd have to see sort of the examples and who pushes back on it, but you know, this stemmed from Chick-fil-A. Of course, Chick-fil-A has said, we don't want this named after us. We're not really part of it. But this stemmed from local officials in San Antonio saying that they would not allow Chick-fil-A at the airport and that they had that authority to do that. And they're saying, why should officials, local officials actually, be able to do that? Chick-fil-A has supported different organizations. I think it's not even, I think it's through its sort of separate entity, but they've supported different entities that people claim discriminate. So, you know, the question is whether in practice it will really mean anything. And I've heard people saying that it probably wouldn't.
But it plays into this larger debate over sort of legislating religious freedom and how that intersects with LGBTQ rights across the country. Could a law like this potentially have broader implications across the country?
Well, we've seen that. The current occupant of the vice presidency has some familiarity. Mike Pence ran into a lot of trouble when something like this was going through the state house in Indiana, and he was governor. There were calls for boycotting the state. The NCAA got on board. I think it depends on where it happens. This is happening in Texas. I think the Texas legislature wants to make a statement here. It doesn't seem like this is rising to the level of going to be national boycotting, but I feel like a broken record. But I think what we see happening in all these stories is the extremes and those in political office are trying to make statements to benefit themselves, to appeal to their base. And it's something that is not changing things for most of America. It's just raising more drama and, in truth, more tension and conflict.
All right, we have so many other things that we could talk about for the rest of the hour, but we're going to move on to something a bit lighter, taking you to one of the most influential streets in America, not Wall Street, but Sesame Street. The iconic children's television program introduced a new character this week named Carly. She's a young Muppet in foster care. Here's a clip of Elmo meeting Carly.
Why is Carly so sad?
I don't really want to tell you about it.
She's having a hard time, Elmo. But we're here for her. We're her for now parents. Hey, Carly. Mm-hmm. Hey, we know some things are hard to talk about, but we're listening.
The educational organization behind Sesame Street created Carly to highlight a new initiative that supports children in foster care. According to the organization, the number of foster children in the U.S. has grown for 5 consecutive years. Carly's debut comes following the show's introduction of a Muppet with autism 2 years ago. A mother told Sesame Street she used the character to explain to her daughter she's autistic. The girl responded, "So I'm amazing too, right?" Lisa Desjardins is a correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Thank you, Lisa.
What a pleasure.
Edward Luce is chief U.S. columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. Great having you here.
Thanks so much.
And Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent and associate editor of Politico. Thanks, Anita.
Thanks for having me.
As we wrap up the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, we leave you with a song from the video Sesame Street released this week. It features Carly and her for now parents and Elmo, of course. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai and Ben Privett. The digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about them and the whole production crew, visit the1a.org/staff. We'll dig into international news next. Stay close.
You belong.
I belong.
You belong.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Kimberly Adams from Marketplace, in for Joshua Johnson. Happy Friday. We're thrilled to have you along for this week's Friday News Roundup. India and Australia re-elect their prime ministers. The UK is about to start looking for a new one. Here, lawmakers work across the aisle in an effort to keep Syria in the headlines, but it's Iran that continues to be the prime target for the White House. And we'll make time to talk about a huge vote in Europe that doesn't involve too much politics. Here with me this week, a top team to guide us through the biggest international stories from around the world. Mark Landler is White House correspondent for The New York Times. Great to see you.
Great to see you.
Susan Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker and global affairs analyst for CNN. Susan, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
And the BBC's Washington bureau chief, Paul Danahar. Paul is author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Paul, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with China. Not a great week for the People's Republic following President Trump's executive order that restricted U.S.-based companies from doing business with Huawei. Google limited the access Huawei phones had to its services. That's since been relaxed, but only for 90 days. Another Chinese tech firm is now in the crosshairs, but it's what the country's scientists are doing to the ozone that could cause most alarm. Mark, President Trump rolled out a $16 billion plan to help farmers hit by the trade conflict with China and suggested on Thursday that Huawei could potentially be a bargaining chip in settling this dispute. How bad could things get and for whom?
Well, you know, clearly the trade war has kind of entered a new phase, and President Trump is showing actually remarkable commitment to pursuing it, even at some political cost in the United States. And he tried to mitigate that cost with the aid for the farmers. I think President Trump has actually calculated that being tough on China is good politics going into 2020. He's gone after some of the Democratic candidates, notably Joe Biden, for not facing up strongly against China. But there's also an ideological, a very strong ideological component to this. The administration believes, and with some evidence, that companies like Huawei, which is affiliated with the Chinese military, are sort of stalking horses for China to infiltrate information networks in the future, and that they can be very easily turned against the United States and its allies in the years to come, particularly if a company like Huawei, which manufactures smartphones, becomes sort of the de facto industry standard. So what today was this week has been about is effectively isolating Huawei and denying it, depriving it of access to things like the Google Android network, which really hobble the company in its attempt to become this world champion in telecom. And that's driving the administration's most recent moves.
But is the administration being effective in convincing other countries to block this?
I think that they've got support on many different levels. I think everyone around the world is basically fed up with China. They did a kind of softly, let's try and negotiate their way out of all these problems we're having with China, and they all failed. And I think there's a kind of grudging respect, probably. They probably don't want to admit it, but not publicly. But I think Donald Trump has actually tackled China the way that China can and must be tackled. Because at the end of the day, trying to play nice with China has never worked. It's not a country where sort of sitting back and letting people walk over you is accepted there. And they've tried to do that in other places. And I think Donald Trump has actually got quite an effective way of tackling them. But there are countries like in the UK, for example. I mean, they were initially reluctant, I think, to kind of jump on the Huawei ban. They've realized that actually long term, it's probably in their interest and it will impact on some of the kind of local cell phone providers. But I think the whole world is basically saying, we've tried everything else, let's try this. And they're with him.
Susan?
Right. So I think the challenge is that it's much easier to diagnose the problem at this point than it is to provide an effective solution. And that's where I might disagree just a little bit. I think that it's true that there's been a significant shift in the attitude across the political spectrum here in the United States about China. There's a sense, Joe Biden notwithstanding, that the previous really long-term strategy of trying to integrate China into the world economy and have them play by the rules of these international institutions has failed. And I agree that even in Europe, where there's some reluctance, that has become more or less a new conventional wisdom. However, I think when you look at the spectacle of the president, you know, having to convene in the White House a program of $16 billion worth of aid for American farmers, they're hit by the trade war that he himself has unleashed. And the politics of it look pretty increasingly difficult for the president. In fact, the hardest hit states in the country because of this trade war are the red states that provided, by some accounts, the margin of victory for the president. So I think it's a political problem for him, especially because it hasn't achieved the deal that he actually thought was in reach just a couple weeks ago. And, you know, Trump has really taken this turn toward a more aggressive stance because it appeared that he was on the brink of negotiating this deal with Xi Jinping, and who at the last minute pulled the plug. And actually, on the Chinese side this week, I thought it was quite interesting to hear some of the rhetoric coming from the Chinese leader telling his people, essentially, this is a new long march, referencing back to the communist struggle in the 1940s and the idea that it would require hardship on their side, preparing the Chinese that this was not going to be something that was going to be over imminently. So I think that's significant. Both sides seem to be digging in for a long conflict. So it's not clear what the results are going to be yet.
But I think it's quite important that actually China's had to take that step, because they'd had no obstacles at all, pretty much, over the last kind of 10, 15 years. It was basically do what you want. And I think the fact that Xi Jinping was so convinced that actually he could do what he wants, he certainly has done that locally. He completely dominates politics and the Communist Party in China, that actually having something as a bit of a setback and making him focus a little bit more internally, perhaps, means that I think the rest of the world can take a bit of a breather and work up a concrete, you know, thought-through plan. This is not necessarily a very thought-through plan, but it has given the rest of the world a bit of a time to think, how are we going to approach them in the future? Because they were just steamrolling their way across the world, and something had to stop them and slow them down a little bit.
So speaking of the brass tacks of how this slowing down is actually working, Google has now moved to limit the services it's providing to Huawei. Mark, how does that work?
Well, Google is a vital partner for a company like Huawei, because Google supplies many of the apps that make smartphones attractive and appealing to customers. And so by depriving Huawei of access to Google, it also deprives it of all these apps. And if you're a worldwide supplier of handsets and you're not on the Android network, that's an enormous gap in your service coverage, and presumably would then lead telecom companies in the UK and Europe, Japan, which all happened this week, to make similar decisions. So that's sort of how it happens on brass tacks. I think what's interesting also is this administration has sort of weaponized these forms of trade moves. So, you know, the trade war has largely been cast in terms of tariffs. We've imposed tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars of Chinese goods. They've imposed retaliatory tariffs. But this is, in fact, another form. You deprive the Chinese of access to American technology, to access to American companies like Google. And that's yet another front in the trade war, and arguably one that may be just as painful for the Chinese, because the Chinese economy is really driven around creating national champions. And Huawei is a very visible big company. It's almost not an exaggeration to say that they think of it as their Apple or as their Google. So if you hobble this company internationally, that's symbolically a big defeat for the Chinese as well. And the administration across the board has been very, very aggressive in using export controls as another weapon in their sort of armory of weapons for this trade war.
It's a nice irony as well that it was having to give up intellectual property to the Chinese to get into the market in the first place, which caused so much upset. So now taking that away from them again is kind of a nice way of giving them a quiet kicking back.
And you talked about the visibility of Huawei, and then there's another company that's now the target of the U.S. government that's not quite so visible. The Trump administration is now eyeing China's Hikvision, one of the world's largest manufacturers of surveillance tools, in the steadily increasing trade hostilities that we're having. What is the administration specifically planning to do with Hikvision, Mark?
Well, I mean, Hikvision is one of the largest manufacturers of closed circuit video equipment. And the idea here is the same. They want to keep this company out of the U.S. market and deprive it of access to any U.S. technology. This goes to a kind of a parallel concern about China. Not only is there concern the Chinese are trying to infiltrate 5G communications networks, but that China is in effect trying to create a surveillance state, not just in its own country, but perhaps all over the world. And so Hikvision would be viewed by the administration as yet another step in that campaign, and that's what they're trying to stop.
And Susan, how long has this been a consideration? I mean, how soon might we see this action from the administration to actually implement it?
Well, who knows? I mean, we have a lot of zigging and zagging on the policy side, but I think Mark is right that, broadly speaking, it represents both a shift and one that is largely supported. Again, it's not just a Trump administration thing. I do think there has been a very specific shift among Democrats as well as Republicans in their desire to confront the Chinese. And this might be an area in particular on the surveillance side where there's a coming together. Remember that China has really perfected in some ways the fusion between technology and surveillance, between using technology to harness and renew a kind of authoritarianism. Look at the imprisonment, if you will, of more than 1 million Uyghurs in China's region of Xinjiang, which largely has been accomplished also using kinds of surveillance and an overwhelming presence of the Chinese that, A, Americans are not eager to export, and B, you see a new definition of trade policy and national security policy coming together with Trump.
Mark, I'm going to try this out. Chlorofluorocarbon 11, or CFC 11, is a chemical whose release leads to the rapid breakdown of our ozone layer. And back in 2010, global production of the chemical was supposed to stop. But that's not exactly what happened. There's a new report out telling us what did, and it says that there may have been some in China. What does this report say, and when did scientists first realize something was wrong?
Well, the suspicion about this has existed for some time, and what we saw in the past few days, in the past week, was a sort of a confirmation that not only was this the emission of this CFC coming from East Asia, which we knew, but actually from a region of China. And so what's significant about it is this is an environmental threat that we sort of thought we had got our arms around. The Montreal Protocol was contributing to a radical diminution in the use of these CFCs, and there was a belief that the ozone hole was well on the way to being healed, to being fixed by the middle of this century. Suggests that that's not the case, and it suggests that China is the violator, the culprit. And what's sort of interesting about this is not that China would have polluting factories. We know they have polluting factories. But one area where the Chinese have been quite aggressive, is addressing emissions in the context of climate change. You recall the Obama administration signed a landmark deal with the Chinese on climate change. And so there was a belief that the Chinese government was trying as best as it could to tackle the threat of pollution in its own country. But I think this just points up the challenge they face with just thousands and thousands of factories and an economy that needs to grow at a certain rate. It's very difficult for them to keep an eye and keep a rein on all of these emissions. And so the Chinese are now saying, we're going to look into this and answer these charges. And it'll be interesting to see how they respond. I mean, on one level, as I said, they've been quite proactive in addressing climate change. Whether they will go after these factory owners and eliminate the CFCs, it will be interesting to see. It's a sort of a test of their ability to crack down and sort of put environmental concerns ahead of their need for breakneck economic growth.
Paul, any other international response that you've heard so far on this?
I think the thing about China, and it's also true of India, which we're talking about next, is that environmentalism is seen as something that you can really worry about when you've got your economy sorted out, when you've got hygiene sorted out and sewers sorted out and everything else. Whereas in the West, it's a big issue for us because we do have most of the ordinary stuff in life sorted out. There's some reluctance amongst the people of both India and China to actually commit to this, because they're basically saying, well, it's all right for you guys. You've done all you need to do to grow. We need to do this to grow. So I think there's the Europeans are saying, they must tackle it and all the rest of it. But a lot of developing countries are saying, well, yeah, but until you guys help us get to where you are, you need to be picking up the kind of cost of this, not us. And so it tends to split in terms of international reaction, depending on where your economy is in the scale of things and how much you think that the Western governments did all their polluting to get where they are. And now you're trying to stop us build our own economies.
Right. Let's go ahead and move on to India. Narendra Modi, India's incumbent prime minister, led his party to a stunning election victory on Thursday. It was the strongest victory the Hindu nationalists ever had. Susan, tell us more about that.
Well, that's right. I think it's arguably, one of the most significant stories, not only of the week, but of the year, in the sense that First of all, this is the largest democracy in the world. 600 million people voted in this election. Think about that. It also was the highest election turnout ever in India's history. 67% of the population turned out. Narendra Modi, as with President Trump here in the United States, as with other leaders of this sort, is a very polarizing figure. And I think he brought out an enormous turnout of people on you know, who liked him as well as people who disliked him passionately. India under Modi has become a much more assertive but also more ethnically nationalist country. And I think it's really striking that you've seen this kind of result for him with a stark shift away a little bit from that economic message that brought him to power a number of years ago and really towards security. And rather than being forced to answer in some ways for some of the ongoing challenges and troubles of India's efforts to develop its economy, he's returned to some of the familiar language around the threats from Pakistan, from terrorism, and from security in a way that I think really did significantly boost his percentage.
And also, Paul, his populism and sort of these grand gestures for the poor, like building tens of millions of toilets throughout the country, clearly resonated with people.
Yeah, but they didn't actually work very well. I mean, the thing was that there should have been an anti-incumbency vote against him, because a lot of things that he said he was going to do, he didn't manage to do. But Susan's right. I think there was the attack in Kashmir against Indian troops, and then the response by Modi of crossing the line of control and attacking targets inside Pakistan put him on the front foot. He was very much on the back foot before. So he kind of appealed to the kind of the nationalism. And there is a really strong sense of patriotism and nationalism in India, particularly when it comes to Pakistan. I think the thing about Modi is he's changed the game in Indian politics. This was about the most presidential style election India's had since Indira Gandhi's kind of era. This was an election about him. And he's become the kind of symbol, not just of kind of of Indian kind of status on the national stage and the international stage, but also he's the lightning rod for Hindutva, the kind of pride in Hinduism. And that's caused a great deal of concern amongst many of the secular parts, the Muslims and the Christians. But it's also a reflection on how badly the Congress Party did. Congress was led by the latest in the dynasty, Rahul Gandhi, who lost his own seat in Amethi, which was a seat held by his mother before and his grandfather. I mean, just like everyone in the Gandhi family has kind of come from Amethi. And the fact that he lost that and had to go and get a vote somewhere else down in Kerala was an illustration of how weak the opposition was. So yes, it's great for Modi, but it also reflects the fact that the opposition in India is incredibly divided and there's no one really able to stand up against him.
And Mark, it also reflects the rise of sort of right-leaning populist figures around the world.
Yeah, well, it was a very interesting week for elections. And it was not actually a clean sweep for the right. You had in Australia, Scott Morrison win. Again, a leader who was running an uphill battle was expected by many people to lose. And he won. He won on a tough on immigration message. He also won on the fact that Australia hasn't had a recession for many years and continues to be performing relatively well. So that was a vote for sort of status quo over change, but again, with a rightward tinge. The outlier this week was Indonesia, where you had the incumbent president win. He's a more moderate democratic figure against a more strongman figure, Prabowo Subianto, who had ties to the Suharto family that once ruled Indonesia. And he won. And again, Prabowo, who ran against him once before, was expected to do well in this election. He's contesting the results, and there's been some violence there. So we'll see how that plays out. So it's funny. Indonesia, a country I once covered as a foreign correspondent, has often marched to its own drummer internationally. And again, this week, we sort of see it bucking the tide of strongman rulers. Certainly, you have a strongman in India, a strongman in China, a strongman in the United States, a strongman in Turkey. But in Indonesia, you have a much more conciliatory democratic figure. And that makes that country, which is often overlooked in the West, always an interesting place.
Although, interestingly, speaking of elections, what we don't know, and we're very likely to be talking about right-wing populism again over the weekend when the results of the European elections are known.
Yeah, we're going to come to that. Let's go ahead and move to Europe. But first to the UK, specifically London, where earlier this morning, British Prime Minister Theresa May bowed to the inevitable and announced that she would resign on June the 7th. Here's part of her statement to reporters gathered outside 10 Downing Street.
I will shortly leave the job that it has been the honour of my life to hold. the second female Prime Minister, but certainly not the last. I do so with no ill will, but with enormous and enduring gratitude to have had the opportunity to serve the country I love.
Paul, there was a lot of emotion in that statement, but did she bring this on herself?
She's had a really terrible premiership. I mean, it began going really badly wrong in 2017 when she thought she was going to get a bigger majority and she lost her majority. And then she had to lean on the kind of the Northern Irish unionists, who were very right wing and who care only really fundamentally about the union with the rest of the United Kingdom. And then she did a deal that basically threatened that. So it was going badly from then on. And she's not really, I mean, the thing about it was, there were lots of people that wanted to take over her job, but only when she'd done all the really difficult, bad stuff. And so she never had the support of anyone behind her. I mean, they all sit there going, rah, 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 but they were all sharpening their knives, waiting for the moment they could shuffle her off. They expected it to be once she got her Brexit deal over the line, then they would get rid of her. But then she made a number of errors and she went backwards and forwards. She didn't start talking about consensus until she was basically on her way out. So I think history will look at her depending on how the next person does. If the next person wraps this up quickly, people will say she was the worst prime minister in modern times. If they struggle too, they may be more sympathetic.
Susan, who might be that next person?
Well, that's a good question. You know, kind of like Madonna in the United States, he's known by one name, Boris. That's Boris Johnson, the flamboyant former foreign secretary and mayor of London. He is a controversial figure. He said already today he doesn't envision giving any more time to the United Kingdom past the final extension they were once again granted by the European Union to Halloween. We'll see if that holds. Theresa May tried and failed three times. She could not achieve the Brexit deal and outcome that she wanted to lead the country out of the European Union as voters had voted in 2016. In fact, you know, May's premiership was defined from the beginning. And to me, it's always been this incredible irony that, you know, she didn't support Brexit and yet became the prime minister who vowed to deliver it and, of course, could not achieve it. So will the Conservative Party go now to a leader who is a more advocate of a no-deal Brexit even, or at least taking a harder line in support of Brexit, one of the people who brought Britain this in the first place? That seems to be the betting, whether it's Boris Johnson or someone else. But I agree, it's not at all clear that if there was an achievable deal, it wouldn't have happened already. So it doesn't seem to me that whoever's inheriting this job at this moment has an obvious path to success.
And today's drama in London played out as millions of people have been voting in the European election. Around 370 million people are eligible to vote across 28 countries. Today, they will decide who gets to represent them at the European Parliament. Other than being big, they're traditionally very dull, but not this year.
Tommy, where's your milkshake? Tommy, where's your milkshake? La 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 la.
I don't think it's about North or South. I don't think it's about rich or poor. I don't even think it's about Brexit or Remain anymore. I think it's whether or not you think it's funny or clever or acceptable to throw something, a milkshake or anything else, over a politician simply because you disagree with them.
On the campaign trail in the UK, protesters have taken to throwing milkshakes at right-wing candidates. At one point, police in Scotland asked McDonald's to stop selling them, fearing further milky assaults at a nearby Brexit rally. But the real mess is still coming. Paul, for new readers, explain why Europe is voting and why the UK, who voted to leave the EU, is even bothering to take part.
Well, it doesn't have a choice because it's still legally part of the EU. These elections they happen on a kind of on a cycle, like all elections around the world. Europe's been really kind of battered by immigration over the last few years. That has led a kind of an increase in support to right-wing parties that are trying to curb immigration. In the UK, we did not expect to be taking part because we expected to be out by then, by now. Because we aren't out, we had to take part. That was one of the reasons why Theresa May basically lost her job, because she couldn't deliver on this. She said that she, under her premiership, she could see no way she could carry out the next European elections, and she had to. I mean, the reality is that Europe is very, very divided, and it's, you don't really see that so much because the focus is on the UK. And the trouble that the UK has is kind of overshadowing everything else. When it's finished and the spotlight turns back to the issues within the EU, I think we'll find that it's not the UK versus the EU. There's lots of internal mess going on there as well.
And Susan, what about the other 27 members of the European Union? How concerned are they that come Sunday we'll see a surge of support for candidates, you know, like the Brexiters that have it out for the EU and want to see a return to the nation state?
Well, there's no question that's going to be a part of the narrative. And you've seen already that in the UK, it's Nigel Farage's Brexit Party that seems to be leading in the polls. You see in France, Marine Le Pen's hard right party. Then, of course, in Hungary and Poland, you have parties at the far right standing to gain in the European elections. You have inside Germany the Alternative for Germany, which just this year has become represented in all of Germany's regional parliaments for the first time ever. You have a group like that. And so, you know, Paul's right. This is something that far transcends what's going on, this internal crisis in the United Kingdom. However, one thing that's interesting, I think, that doesn't get as much attention is that in a way there's been sort of a backlash to this British crisis. And you do see countries around the European Union, even if they have a different view of democracy than some of the countries like France and Germany, they don't want to leave the European Union, which they have associated both with stability in the post-communist era and also with economic growth. In Poland, for example, which has a very illiberal government, 90% of voters polled recently said that they want to make sure they remain inside the European Union.
Very quickly, Mark, Austria has had a really tough week. One video brought down the entire government. It showed the head of the country's far-right party talking to a woman who claimed to be the niece of a Russian oligarch. The scandal could see criminal charges being brought against the head of Austria's Freedom Party. What's going on here?
Well, it's a bit of a very distant echo of all the discussion we've had in the U.S. about possible collusion between President Trump and his campaign and the Russians. This is a case where the Freedom Party, which is the far right party in Austria, the leader who's in the government, he's not the prime minister, but he's in the government, was basically taped clearly colluding with a Russian official. it's forced the coalition to fall apart. What's interesting about the Austrian prime minister, who was actually at the White House meeting President Trump a few months ago, is he's sort of the benign face of the right in Europe. He's not as sort of extreme in his views. He's a very smooth talking character, and he had kind of put an acceptable face on a far right coalition. By losing his coalition partner, it's now very unclear whether he can continue put together a new coalition. Perhaps he has to tack to the center. So it's yet another example of how these struggles are playing out in Europe.
We'll move on to Iran, where the war of words between Iran and the United States continues to ratchet up. The U.S. has imposed more sanctions and deployed military vessels to the Persian Gulf in response to what government officials call a, quote, credible threat against American citizens. And in a closed-door session Tuesday, Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan briefed Congress on this latest. Here's Secretary Shanahan talking to reporters after the hearing.
We acted on that credible intelligence. So we have deterred attacks based on our reposturing of assets, deterred attacks against American forces. Our biggest focus at this point is to prevent Iranian miscalculation. We do not want the situation to escalate. This is about deterrence, not about war.
That was Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan talking to reporters on Tuesday about recent actions taken on Iran. He said de-escalation is the goal, but 2 days later, yesterday, we learned that the Department of Defense requested that Trump send several thousand more troops to the region. Susan Glasser, what does this request for more troops tell us?
It tells us that probably nobody inside Washington can tell you what the actual policy is at the moment towards Iran. Are we escalating? Are we de-escalating? Well, it depends on who you talk to inside the Trump administration, which has remained fairly divided, at least on the tactical level, about what exactly to do right now. And part of the reason why is it actually depends on your analysis of who escalated first. Are the Iranians right now responding to American provocations, or is it in fact quite the opposite, and Americans responding to concerning intelligence that suggests that Iranians were deploying new weapons targeted at them? We actually have one of these situations Russians that is almost a textbook classic of the potential to blunder into war, where both sides say they don't want it and in fact are simply taking normal escalatory moves in response to the other person. That's always the risk in the Middle East. It's particularly so right now. You have a situation where the Trump administration came into office. As you know, the president called the Iran nuclear deal the worst deal ever. Exactly 1 year ago, in May of 2018, President Trump decided to unilaterally withdraw from that deal. Since then, he and his administration have had a series of gradually increasing pressure. They call it the maximum pressure campaign on Iran, including more sanctions, including more military moves. And the response generated to this by the Iranians at this point is really what's led to the current situation. It's very risky on both sides. But of course, here in the United States, again, you have a president who's not always on the same page, as you know, with his advisors when it comes to foreign policy. And John Bolton, the national security advisor, I think there are critics on across the political spectrum in the United States who worry that this is John Bolton's Iran policy and not necessarily Donald Trump's.
It does seem like quite a few mixed messages, Mark.
It does. And I think Susan raises an important point, because this is not a president who is as involved in the details of foreign policy as most, if not all, of his predecessors. Donald Trump has sort of operated on the general principle that he can bluster and bully, and in so doing, bring an adversary to the table. This is very much the playbook he ran with North Korea, and then perhaps extract a spectacular deal. It didn't work with North Korea until now. And it's worth pointing out that the difference here is we had a deal with the Iranians, which he walked away from. So I'm not sure why he believes that this kind of a playbook would work with the Iranians. But I think that his lack of attention to the detail in part is what empowers a very wily bureaucratic figure like John Bolton, who has a deep ideological bias, who has talked openly about regime change for years in Iran, allows someone like Bolton to operate quite independently. And to the point that Susan was making, not necessarily frame a formal policy of waging war on Iran, but maneuver the U.S. into a place where we blunder into a conflict, one that the president himself, by all accounts, does not want.
Paul, what has Iran done in response to all of this?
Well, it's difficult to know what Iran's doing, because what we find out about them depends on the intelligence that we're supposedly getting. And I think one of the issues here is that you can read intelligence any way you want. That's what America did when it went into Iraq. So, yes, I'm sure there were sort of weapons being moved around, but how do we know they weren't being moved around 6 months ago? I mean, if you want to interpret something as an escalation, you can. What I think is interesting is if you look at the different things that are going on, the attempt by members of the White House to get the Muslim Brotherhood banned as terrorists, that was done for Saudi Arabia. If you look at the kind of WhatsApp story that we had recently, which was about allowing Arab Gulf states to be allowed to use technologies developed by Israel to go after their kind of human rights opponents. There's lots of things that are going on around the Gulf that are basically kind of getting all the different countries that are anti-Iran aligned. Everybody's doing everybody else favors. And John Bolton sitting in the middle of all this, we know where he wants to go. He wants to go towards confronting Iran. So I think Mark's point is absolutely right. There are lots of players in this who are being much more sophisticated towards their goals. And the president's just kind of sitting there going, I don't want to have a war. But he may wake up one morning and find he's got one, whether he wants it or not. And you can't see the figure in the White House at the moment who's grabbing anyone by the collar and saying, what are you doing? Stop. And I think that's the worrying thing. We've lost all the big animals in the White House that we thought were the grown-ups that would stop someone actually stumbling the country into a war.
Well, I think it lost the grown-ups, presumes that the grown-ups actually delivered what we expected. The interesting thing about the Trump administration is that there were people who were at odds with the president, and the history of every single one of them, which does not bode well for John Bolton, is that eventually Trump has gotten rid of them.
So let's stay in the Middle East, but move on to Syria. The fighting in Syria is still not done. Earlier this week, a group of bipartisan lawmakers sent a letter to President Trump warning, quote, pockets of ungoverned space have allowed terrorist groups such as Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and their affiliates to keep parts of Syria in their stranglehold, end quote. What's the backstory there, Mark? Why did lawmakers feel the need to send this letter?
Well, this is an area where you've seen some rare dissent between President Trump and some of his staunchest Republican allies in the Congress. And it all goes back to this very abrupt decision he made to withdraw 2,000 American troops from Syria, declaring that our battle there was over. We went in there to vanquish ISIS. We did it, and we're leaving. He did that over the objections of his defense secretary, Jim Mattis, which led Mattis to resign. And he did it over the objections of John Bolton, who I think has worked very quietly to actually reverse some of this. And you've seen the president backtrack. He's agreed to leave small numbers of troops here and there. But clearly what these lawmakers are saying, Republicans and Democrats, is this threat is by no means extinguished in Syria. And for us to pull out in this kind of abrupt, very hasty, ill-considered way will only allow Syria, A, to lapse into even more violence, but B, become a seedbed for the next militant threat against the United States. So this is a rare case where you are actually seeing some Republicans say, Mr. President, you haven't handled this right. Please reconsider.
And Susan, what specifically are they asking for the White House and the administration to do?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, really, I think at the moment, Mark is right. It's not even a question of that in the sense that right now nobody knows what the Syria policy is. And given that we also don't know what the Iran policy is, and Syria is inextricably caught up with the Iran fight, it's very clear that the president himself is not interested in an American foreign policy that's framed around a war on terrorism, that's framed around a forever conflict. He prefers things that are much more black and white, that are much more, you know, here's a conflict, here's a resolution, preferably with me in the center of things. That's not how the civil war in Syria is going to end. And so part of the problem is that, you know, you could write a letter like that every week if you're members of Congress. The issue really is just that President Trump is going to push and push and push on Iran while at the same time events on the ground are continuing to unfold. And you have that as well in Yemen, where you also have a disagreement between members of the president's own party on Capitol Hill and also Democrats who are concerned that the Trump administration has been supporting Saudi Arabia in its conflict. The Saudis say this is actually a front in the multi-pronged war against Iran and its Iranian proxies fighting in Yemen. Now we're going to have a new trigger point because actually the administration, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are about to try to bypass Congress to send even more weapons into that civil war. So that's the fight that I would look to between Congress and the administration on Middle East policy that's coming up this week.
Keeping it with Syria, though, lawmakers aren't the only ones looking for President Trump to do something about that war in particular. The PBS NewsHour's Nick Schifrin spoke with young Syrians at an orphanage in Idlib. Here's a translation of what they said.
We are pleading with Mr. Trump, please stop the criminals from bombing our villages and to protect the Syrian people, the defenseless civilians.
We are pleading with Mr. Trump to stop the massacres in our village and protect the civilians, children, women, and elderly, and to stop the spilling of blood.
Paul, what's going on in the Idlib province right now?
Idlib is basically, you know, the thing about Syria is the areas that the government control, we don't know a lot about. The areas where the government doesn't control, we know they're being constantly bombed and attacked. And we saw that this week with a British team being drone attacked by the Syrian government. The issue we have in Syria is that fundamentally the Islamic State stopped being an army because they got beat as an army, and they've gone back to being a guerrilla organization, and they're much harder to tackle. They emerged from a guerrilla organization, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They've gone back to that. So the problem isn't over. But as Susan was saying, this administration and particularly the president like to say, oh, we've solved this problem. The Middle East is whack-a-mole. Everything is connected. The president doesn't like seeing connections. He wants everything to be an isolated thing that he deals with and moves on. And so what we've got in Syria is what's going to continue to be in Syria. We're going to have guerrilla groups. We're going to have terrorist groups. We're going to have the government trying to put them down. We're going to have the Syrians and the Russians and the Lebanese and Hezbollah and Israel and America all fiddling around in this, and it will not be resolved. And the problem that you have in places like Idlib, which is still held by rebel groups, is until they've been bombed into submission, the fighting will continue.
Very quickly, before we move on from Syria, what do we know about the reports of recent chemical weapons attacks by the Assad regime, Susan? Is there any evidence yet?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You did see President Trump's special envoy for Syria, Jim Jeffrey, a very respected foreign ambassador, saying that this is something they're taking seriously. They're investigating it. As you know, this has been the only thing that has gotten President Trump's attention about Syria's two previous chemical weapons attacks inside the country actually did prompt him to order missile strikes earlier in his administration. This is a horrible technique that the Assad regime has resorted to throughout the civil war. So it's highly credible, unfortunately, that they would potentially have resorted to this again. As Paul pointed out, actual hard facts and information from inside the country right now are very, very hard to come by. But I think it is notable just in the sense that we know the president has taken previous reports, credible reports of chemical weapons attacks seriously inside Syria. And that might be one of the only times in which he's chosen to actively intervene as opposed to passively keep going with the American presence. And partially, I should say, that's because there is one other guiding principle of Trump foreign policy we haven't talked about yet today, and that's do what President Obama did not do. And so he came into office believing that President Obama had failed terrifically by establishing a red line on the use of chemical weapons inside Syria and then failing to enforce it. So for President Trump, he's been very, very focused, as you know, on reversing what he sees as the misguided policies of his predecessor. So that's one I would watch if they do come back and say, we verified that this was a chemical weapons attack.
Moving on, John Walker Lind, also known as the American Taliban, was released on probation from prison this week after serving for 17 years. At the age of 17, Lind left the U.S. for the Middle East, where he eventually became a volunteer for the Taliban. His release from prison this week angered top White House officials, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Here's how Pompeo described Lind's release to Fox News.
Unexplainable and unconscionable. I recall a review of our processes, all the things that went into this day where he's being allowed out early.
Trump spoke out against the release at a news conference yesterday, saying that if he could have stopped it, he would have. Mark, tell us more about the so-called American Taliban, who he was, and why his release elicited the anger that it did from the White House.
Well, John Walker Lind was a young man who left California and went to the Middle East, and basically trained with Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and found his way into Afghanistan. And during those very, very early days of the war in Afghanistan, he was a huge figure. He was interrogated by the first American soldier who was a casualty in the Afghan war. There's no suggestion that he took part in killing this soldier, but as a result, he became this extremely symbolic figure of betrayal and also a deep sense of unease in the United States that a guy from California could wind up becoming effectively a member of the Taliban. So we've all forgotten perhaps in these 17 tumultuous years how big a deal this was. And so it's an echo of the past, but one that's, of course, very relevant to the present. We just talked about militancy in Syria and the way the Islamic State may be reforming. So it's very much a symbol of that. And that's why we talked about it this week.
All right, let's move to something lighter before we go. Earlier, we talked about some big news out of Europe this week, the fate of Britain's Theresa May. And now tens of millions of people who are voting across the EU. But perhaps the biggest news from this part of the world was made by a Dutch singer called Duncan. Duncan Lawrence from the Netherlands won the 2019 Eurovision Song Contest with his song Arcade. He'd been the bookies' favorite. Italy finished second, Russia third. The Brits were last, but for those who saw her performance, the real loser appeared to be Madonna. Just be thankful that we don't have time to bring you any of her highlights. And we are just about out of time. Huge thanks to our guests this week, Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker and global affairs analyst for CNN. Thank you.
Oh, fantastic to be with you.
The BBC's Washington Bureau Chief, Paul Danahar. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
And to Mark Landler, the White House correspondent for The New York Times.
Thank you, Kimberly.
1A's senior team includes Danielle Knight, Denise Couture, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. The show is edited by Miranda Fulmore. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Marketplace's Kimberly Adams. Thanks so much for listening. Have a nice weekend, everybody. This is 1A. Get me off this roller coaster.